You heard John Schramm announce that a new chapter in the book of Acts. I believe that a great deal of church history may be considered as successive chapters in the book of Acts. And then after that he had a colon, events and people. I will try not to make it boringly detailed, but touch on some significant events and some people that I felt were a great privilege to meet and to deal with. Now the background for what I will speak on tonight. After World War II, well, it started while the war was on, the Christian Church took note that many of the mission areas that were supported by societies in occupied countries like Finland and Norway and Denmark, and particularly the areas that had been ministered to by German mission societies, these were almost without help. And so the National Lutheran Council had to jump in and provide some assistance. Well, when the Lutheran World Federation was organized in the summer of 1947, one of the things that it put on its agenda as a very, very important thing for the church to give immediate attention to would be, now that the war was over, where, particularly in German mission areas, where they could not send out missionaries of their own, that we ought to co-opt missionaries from America, from some of the Scandinavian countries, and that we ought to try to get mission property that had been taken over by government released for the use for which it was intended. So the National Lutheran Council set up a commission called the Commission on Younger Churches and Orphaned Missions, and I was elected as the executive secretary and served during the 6 years, 48 to 54. At the same, or not the same time, but a year after this commission was organized, the Lutheran World Federation had its organizational meeting, and it, through its executive committee, appointed a commission on world mission, and I was asked to serve as the chairman of that commission in order that the work that the National Lutheran Council was doing, because it had the dollars, Lutheran World Action Funds, could be coordinated with the thinking that might go on in a commission that had representation from a broadly Lutheran constituency. Well, serving as the chairman of one and the executive secretary of the other put me pretty much in the center of some things. I think I'm going to start with Tanganyika, because there we had involved the matter of getting missionaries to replace some of the German missionaries, and then also the release of a large amount of property. Tanganyika, today Tanzania, was at one time German East Africa. It was a colony of Germany. But after World War II, this colony was made a mandate area under the League of Nations, and Great Britain was asked to be the mandate power and try to bring this area of the world along to the day of independence. That accounts for the fact that it had been German East Africa, accounts for the fact that there were so many German mission societies working there in Tanganyika. The Leipzig Society was there, the Bethel Society, and the Berlin Society, and some smaller groups. Berlin and Bethel had two large areas wherein they worked, and Leipzig had a sizable area also. It had had a second area, but that had turned over to the Augustana Lutheran Church after World War I. Now, through the arrangement of the International Missionary Council, This was a council wherein practically all Protestant mission bodies had membership, and they sought to work for in the areas where Protestant bodies need to come together and counsel with one another. Well, the IMC, as it was usually referred to, felt that it was desirable that there be a consultation for all mission directors whose churches or societies had work in Africa, that there be a consultation with the British Colonial Office. And so they arranged in the summer of 1948 for a meeting with Sir Andrew Cowan, who was head of the Africa area within the British Colonial Office. Likely a Jew, that with that name, but a very fine man to deal with.
What was his name, Chris?
Cowan, C-O-H-E-N, Sir Andrew Cowan. The fact he'd been knighted meant that the government had recognized that he had done some excellent work. We found that meeting very, very helpful. Then I went from that meeting in London over to a meeting of the German Evangelical Missionary Council. This council was for all the German societies, about the same thing as the National Lutheran Council, or today the Lutheran Council USA, is for the member churches in this country. I was eager to have an opportunity to meet with these men in order to get their points of view before I went out to Tanganyika, and then before I stepped into other areas where the Germans were at work. I received a very cordial welcome. I couldn't have been received with any more welcome than what they received me. I told them that I would like to know what their policies were with reference to the areas where they had been at work. I said, we have a certain amount of money that the National Lutheran Council has put at our disposal, given by our people under the slogan Lutheran World Action. And I said, as is often always true in the work of the church, you never have as much money as you could actually use. Therefore, we feel that we need to be good custodians over the money that we can put at the disposal of the areas where you have work. And I said, therefore, we would like all the information you can give us. Well, one of the men, Dr. Herman Elfers, who was the executive secretary of the Hermannsburg Mission Society, said, I am sorry, I cannot give you any information about our work. He said, you see, our policy has been from the time that the society was organized never to tell people about our needs, only to talk to God. Well, I said, this is a wonderful tradition you've had to cast your burdens upon the Lord. But I said, see, this is reversed now. Here's money that our people has put on at our disposal, and the Lord expects us to be good stewards. And the way in which it will be used will likely be on the basis of the recommendations that I give to our commission. Now, how can I said, make any recommendations with regard to the needs that the area where you are working if you don't give me some information? I said, I don't think we can expect that God will give us a vision so we can see just what the needs are for your field. Well, he smiled a little then and said, in order that we might be good stewards, he would be willing to help us and to give us some information. Well, that was our first issue that we had to overcome. Then in going out to Tanganyika, On the way out, I stopped off for a brief chat with Sir Andrew Cohen, for I thought he might have something to suggest. And I told him one of the big issues that we will have to discuss when I get to Tanganyika will be the return of the mission properties to the churches. The government had had all the mission properties, and then in a sense they rented it to the missionaries that we had that were doing work during the days of the war. But this was an unsatisfactory relationship. Dr. or Sir Andrew Cohen said, I cannot say one word about that, for we leave that entirely in the hands of the government in Tanganyika. And the man in Tanganyika, who would be regarded as a sort of a prime minister if it were an independent government, was called the secretary, representing His Majesty the King. I guess it was Her Majesty the Queen. When we got out there, a meeting had been arranged by the missionary, Dr. George Anderson of the Augustana Church, who had been our contact point in Tanganyika. When we came into that meeting, Dr. Anderson was with me, and the General Secretary, Bruce Hutt by name, and then the Attorney General, I don't recall his name, big, heavy-set man. Bruce Hutt sat at the head of the table, and I sat over here to his right. And I made known to him that now that the war was over and our people were concerned about having these areas properly staffed, we would like to know what possibility there might be for German missionaries to be returned to the areas where they had been at work. I said, no, they couldn't do that. They couldn't permit any German missionaries to come back. And as the discussion went on and I asked some questions, then suddenly the Attorney General, sitting down at the other end of the table, slapped his fist on the table so it shook, and he says, never, never will we allow a German missionary back in Tanganyika. Well, when somebody talks with that vehemence, you don't then enter into argumentation. I thought maybe we could come at that a little bit later. So I raised the question of the property issue. I said there is a considerable amount of property here that belongs to the missions, and we think that that ought to be released, and that we could use it and hold it in trust, as it were, for the younger churches that are coming to the fore. Mr. Hutt replied, no, he says, we cannot release any of that property. I said, why not? Well, he said, that cannot be done until a peace treaty has been written. No peace treaty has been written to this day. So if we were to have waited for that, it would have been a long, 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 long time. And I said to Mr. Hutt, well, it isn't likely that there will be a peace treaty very soon, is there? And he kind of just nodded his head, just so I could sense there was a nod there. I said, it seems then that there ought to be the possibility of settling something. I said, I talked to Sir Andrew Cohen about this when I went through London. I just mentioned Cohen and said they should take care of it. But just mentioning that I had talked to his boss, I could see that that made some difference. And then I said, of course, you know what the Versailles Treaty said about mission properties. And I could see from his face that he didn't know, so I didn't wait to shame him into confession of ignorance. I said, you know, At that time, there was a clause written into the Versailles Treaty that no church or mission property could be used as, booty of war. It could not be used as any kind of indemnity. Church and mission properties were to be exempt from anything of that kind. And if I can back up for a moment, here you had the result of the excellent work that the International Missionary Council did. They had a very gifted man who was present at the Versailles Peace Conference. Now that was an iniquitous peace treaty. That is, it was tough. It really set Germany back and prolonged the depression for her. But through the representation of the International Missionary Council, they succeeded in getting that clause written into the Versailles Treaty. Now, I said, you certainly are not going to slip back and do anything less after World War II than what you did back after World War I. Well, he mentioned again, there's no peace treaty. Well, I said, really, there are only three powers that are concerned: Russia, Great Britain, and the United States. And I said, I suspect that your government will not go back on the kind of high ground it took at Versailles. And without having discussed it with State Department in Washington, I am sure that the U.S. government will not go back on the high ground that she took with Britain and with France at that time. So I said, is there any danger entering into a settlement of this matter if two are against the third? Britain and the U.S. would stand together. I'd been watching his face all along, and I could see that when he realized that his own country had been along and made this decision after World War I, that something happened. And then I said, is there really any danger? And then he nodded just briefly. Then he said, well, if we do this, to whom would we cede the property? I said, the Lutheran World Federation, as the custodian for Lutheran interests. And then the Attorney General asked, well, doesn't Germany, the German churches, have membership in the Lutheran World Federation? I said, yes, they do. No, we could never give it to the Lutheran World Federation. Well, I said, how about the USA Committee of the Lutheran World Federation, where there are only United States churches belonging? Well, that U.S. had been a valued ally of Great Britain, so he didn't say other than yes at that. Then he made it clear that if they went this way, they would cede the property to the Crown, and then the Crown would cede the property to the USA Committee of the Lutheran World Federation. And he explained very clearly that was a device so that if any time we should try to sneak it over into the hands of the Germans, then they would be confronted with that it had to go through the Crown first. Well, it was clear that they were very determined at that point. And that's the settlement that we got. Then we raised the question again, how about some medical person? We know of a German medical man who knows the work out here and would be a very valuable person. Well, they said no to all German missionaries, but I could sense that maybe they might allow one who was a specialist, as it were. Now, I had to go back from there to the German Missionary Council. Now, supposing you had been in the position of the German mission directors, who had looked forward to the end of the war when they might once more take up the work, and they had saved a considerable number of Deutschmarks because they hadn't been able to send them out. But then they were washed clean of these Deutschmarks because the American military, in order to put Germany on a sound economic basis, they wiped out 90% of all bank deposits. That is, if you had 100 marks in the bank, 90 of those marks would be wiped out and you'd lost them forever. And 5 marks would be frozen and 5 could be used. Well, this was quite a blow. These directors told me how they had longed for and looked forward because they'd accumulated quite a little bit of reserves. And all of this practically wiped out. Now, to come back to a group of men like that and to tell them the news that they could not send missionaries, at least as of now, and the property could not go back into the hands of the German mission societies. As I rode back on the plane and prayed that God might give me just the right words, I sort of thought that if I had been in their place, I would have felt like in the days when we were boys and somebody might swipe our swimming suit while we were in bathing. That made us, well, something of a predicament. Or swipe our clothes, rather, while we were in bathing. And I said to myself, they could feel this way, here's this young American, and he tells us certain things, but really he's been trying to work this so that the American churches get a hold of it. I prayed to God that he, even by the inflection of my voice, he would convey to them a sense of that I was dealing with them honestly and in truth. And I told it in as much detail as was necessary, and then waited for questions. Everything was silent. And it seemed to me it was an eternity of silence. Finally, the senior director, Dr. Wilhelm Knack, the secretary for the Berlin Mission Society, stood up. And as he stood up and I looked at the suit that he was wearing, it was threadbare almost all over. I imagine that suit was bought sometime before the war and had been used maybe daily. He had an old-fashioned watch chain stretched across the vest. And he stood there looking on the floor and just playing with that watch chain. I thought after a while that might break, you know, if you keep twisting something like that. Something will have to give after a while. And after a long time, these words came through his lips, spoken slowly, deliberately. It is clear we face a new day. And we must walk in God's new way. If I'd have been a Pentecostal, I would have shouted, glory, hallelujah. For in a situation where he could have reacted with resentment and even a touch of hatred, he accepted this. And he said, now we must look for the new way in which God will direct us. And some months after this, when several of the German mission directors met with the Scandinavian directors up in Stockholm, and it was in order that we might devise a way whereby young Scandinavian missionaries could go out to hold the areas where the Germans had been working until the government might change its attitude. And as we went over this, Director Ronicky of the Bethel Mission Society suddenly said, "Who is it that tells us that we Germans cannot go out and work as missionaries?" And I thought, ooh, is that fine spirit that developed at the meeting we had at Herborn in Germany, has that evaporated? And then suddenly said, and his hand shot up, "It is one who is higher than we." And then he closed with some words that brought tears to my face. "But," he said, "I am sure that God will find a way wherein we Germans can also help in his mission." Now, I would have to say that God fashioned a disposition on the part of the German missionaries to absorb everything but not to allow to put them down and to walk forward in cooperation with their other brethren in the Lutheran World Federation and to use every opportunity that God might fashion for them. I can't conceive of a holier moment than what I had when I had the meeting at Herborn and then the meeting at Stockholm. Let me conclude that part of it quickly. After, I think, less than 2 years, we had permission from the government for German missionaries to go back into their areas. Now, there are a lot of things that I ought to perhaps talk about with regard to the work in Tanganyika, but I'm going over some of these things that happened during those years, 48 to 54. Another area, Ethiopia. There were properties that had been taken over. And for that meeting, you had to meet with the emperor, Haile Selassie. And I was carefully schooled in what is proper protocol when you had an audience with the emperor. You bowed as far or as deeply as you could without losing your balance when you came in through the door, and you walked halfway toward the emperor and you repeated that bow, and then you walked over to where the emperor was sitting and you repeated it a third time. And when it came to going out, then you did the same thing, only you backed up. You must not turn your back on the emperor. So I'd practiced a little bit about backing up and not losing my balance and trying to back fairly straight. After, well, there was some conversation, and I started out by saying something to the emperor that I wanted to say, because when the emperor returned to Ethiopia, you know, when Mussolini invaded, he had to leave and he lived in London. One of the Swedish missionaries said that he called on the emperor in London one time, and the emperor asked him if he would conduct a service of worship for them if he brought his family and his servants together. And of course he was glad to do that. The emperor was personally a pious man. He was also supposed to be, was head of the Ethiopian, the Coptic Church. I had read that when Emperor Haile Selassie returned to Ethiopia, he issued a decree telling his people that they must not take revenge on the Italians now when the army was withdrawing. You know, an army of occupation, many of them will marry native women and stay on for that reason. Others have found more opportunity to get land or something like that. So there were Italians that stayed on in Ethiopia. And of course, under the occupation, they didn't treat the Ethiopians too well. And the Ethiopians could really say, now this is our chance to take revenge. But the emperor issued a decree forbidding his people to take revenge on the Italians that remained behind. And then pointed out, we will be living side by side in the future, and let us live as neighbors. When I read that news story, chills went up and down my back. I was so moved by the emperor, before he gets to Ethiopia, blocking the possibility of his people shall start a riot against the Italians. And so I said to the emperor, when I read about the decree that you issued forbidding your people to take revenge on the Italians, right there, I said, I had to thank God for such a noble act. And you know what he shot back at me? That was my duty as a Christian. He didn't want to be complimented on that. That was his duty as a Christian. And then he told me that when he first became emperor, you couldn't buy children to go to school. But now, he said, we cannot build schools fast enough for the children who want to go to school. Couldn't get teachers fast enough. And then he went on to say, on these properties, sure, that would all be settled at once. He being having dictatorial powers, just with a stroke of the pen, all the properties could be released for the use of the churches. This is an aside. When the day came that we built the radio voice of the gospel, a broadcasting station that covered practically all of Africa and the whole Mideast, we would not have had that except for the intervention of the emperor. The bishops, the Coptic bishops, were against it. They thought maybe that this would be, they would lose grip on their people. And the emperor was the go-between and arranged so that that was accomplished. Of course, now it's in the hands of the communist government that is there. But the years that we had it, we acquired the know-how in different parts of Africa, so now they can almost as reasonably as maintaining the station, they can broadcast their programs in many different areas of Africa. I had an opportunity going through Addis Ababa, the capital, on a time when I was just stopping over to see a friend of mine there. This friend happened at that time to be the American ambassador. And when I was there, he asked me, he said, would you like to go to a state dinner this evening? Well, I said, if it's not out of order to invite one who has no reason to go. Well, he says, there are four American congressmen here, and the emperor is giving a party for them. And he said, I'm sure that I can get an invitation for you. And he did. Then I saw something which, you associate with what you have read about great imperial households and the wealth they have. This was a long table, and there was an excellent orchestra of Ethiopians that provided classical music for us through all the dinner period. And everything on the table was gold, plates, not silverware, goldware, knives, forks, spoons, even the vases for the flowers, gold. There wasn't a thing on the table that wasn't gold. That bothered me a little, but one must remember that he had been brought up in this, and he can't make one leap in the direction of putting some of that gold or changing his lifestyle, as it were. I think maybe I'll tell you about one other place where I had to go, of several. In Indonesia, well, all of Indonesia was a colony of the Dutch up until World War II. During the war, the Indonesians organized a Republic of Indonesia, and their headquarters was in Jakarta. It was called Batavia before. And the largest island in this Indonesian archipelago of islands was Sumatra. And in the center of Sumatra, and pretty much the dominant population on that large island, a people called the Batak people. Someone has called them the Prussians of Indonesia. By that they meant they were people of great ability, hard work, and with lots of know-how and the ability to move ahead. And here you had the largest Christian church in all of Asia. And it was known that they had, well, a lot of needs, because the Japanese had occupied Indonesia during the war, and they had burned a lot of Bibles, and hymn books had been burned, and some of their buildings destroyed. And at the meeting of the World Council of Churches in Amsterdam in 1948, the International Missionary Council had approached some Batak delegates that were there and inquired, "What is it that you need?" Well, they didn't act exactly like elfers of the Hermannsburg Mission Society, but they just didn't answer them. Why? For them to have said anything about having any needs would have been as though they were admitting on Dutch territory that they couldn't handle things for themselves, because now they had rebelled and they were a republic. In fact, part of the area was still in the hands of the Dutch, and another part in the hands of the republic. Well, then when the IMC couldn't get anything out of them, and they knew by stories that they had great need, then they said, "You Lutherans better see what you can do." And so they asked us to take responsibility. And I remember I talked with one of these Batak delegates who stopped off in Germany, but I didn't get any more out of him than the IMC did. Then we began to think about this, and it seemed a desirable thing to ask Bishop Sandegren of India, a Swedish missionary, who was an elderly man, to see if he couldn't take with him over to Indonesia. Well, first of all, if he could get in, and then if he could take with him some emissary, maybe a professional person. And Sandegren had no difficulty getting over there from India. And he took with him a Indian doctor of medicine. He looked more, well, as dark as some of the Indians are. Some are every bit as dark as some Africans. Dr. D.R. Williams, very small man, but really a great heart and mind. They got permission. And after Sandegren and Williams got there, well, he left Williams and he went back to India. But Williams wrote back to Sandegren and said, "Oh, he had a big list of things they needed, and he said, they are asking if the Lutheran World Federation will send out a delegation that they may discuss the question of what's required to become a member of the Lutheran World Federation." And so Sandegren and I were delegated to go. We flew in to a city near the coast called Medan. And we lived with a Dutch missionary for a while. And then inquired of the intelligence, the army intelligence, because Medan was under the Dutch, would it be possible to get permission to go into the interior where the Batak church was? Well, after some conversation, the military said yes, and they gave us a pass to go through their own lines, and then the Bataks would have to arrange a permit to come through their line. But she said, you better wait a while to see what kind of reports we get. Well, we cooled our heels in Medan for about a week because there were reports of guerrilla activity. But then one Saturday evening, we got a call from the military saying they thought it would be all right to go in, but that we should stop in a city called Siantar that was about 100 miles inland and not far from the Republican line. And then we should check with the military there. So we went on in. And the military said to us, we will not take your pass away from you. But we remind you that if you go in, you do it at your own risk. Because there has been guerrilla activity again, and we don't know when it may flare up. It may cool off, then flares up. Well, Bishop Sandegren and I went back to a sort of a motel. He was then, about 70 years of age. And I expected him as a senior member to make the decision. But he turned to me and he said, I have lived most of my life, but he said, you have reason to believe that you have some years left in which to work. So you make the decision, he said. I felt very much the junior there, and I didn't quite want to do it, but I recognized also that he spoke sincerely, and for a while there was civil war in my mind. And I was reminded of the Bible verse, thou shalt not tempt the Lord thy God. Would we be tempting God if we risk going in at a time when the military, who seemed to be informed, said there was a lot of guerrilla activity and we would have to go in at our own risk? But as this civil war continued in my mind, then suddenly I was reminded of what Jesus said, he who puts his hand to the plow and turns around is not worthy of the kingdom. Then I knew what God was saying to us. And so I looked at Bishop Sandegren and I said, we're going in. And I can still see that big smile. And he said, very well. So the next morning, we had sent through the military word to the Bataks that we would be coming. And we went in. At the United Nations line of demarcation, because there was an armistice that the United Nations had engineered. And on the other side, there was a small encampment of Republican soldiers. And on this side, there was a small encampment of Dutch soldiers. And when we arrived at this place, there stood the Ephorus, that's the head of their church, and his whole church council. And the Ephorus had us arrange ourselves in a circle so that the UN line of demarcation was the diameter through the circle. And he led us in singing one Christian hymn after another. And then he asked Bishop Sandgren if he would lead us in prayer, and we all bowed. And after the prayer, when we lifted our heads, lo and behold, here there were a couple of Dutch soldiers who had come and joined the circle. And from the other side, there were a couple of Batak soldiers that had come and joined the circle. And I thought, my, what a demonstration of what should be in the kingdom. Enemies and not enemies, neutral or whatever you are. In the kingdom, there is no animosity. Well, then we got into the oldest jalopies that I have ever ridden in. And we went on our way to Baliga, a place about 60 miles farther inland, where the headquarters of the Batak Church was. And every little village that we went through, children came running out and shouting, Merdeka, Merdeka. Merdeka was their word for freedom, freedom. So you could see that the country was gripped by this independence, independence. When we arrived, the women, as is true in most churches, had arranged a meal. The church council and some of their other church members sat down at the table. And after we had eaten, then the Ephorus said, in bidding us welcome, ever since we sent word that we would like a delegation to visit us from the Lutheran World Federation, we have prayed for the safety of that delegation and that it might arrive here in time. And I thought, my, if we had decided to turn around and go back, there, the answer to their prayer would have been denied them. There was a Mohammedan sultan from Arabia that was staying in the same hotel that we were staying in, and who got the same kind of advice that we got. And he turned around and went back. Oh, how grateful I was that evening that God had saved us from turning around and going back. Well, I could tell you about many of the visits that we made in the churches, but there isn't time for that. I want to leave a little time for some questions. It came to talking, that is not that evening, but a few days later, about what their needs were. Then there was no hesitating. We got a long list of things that they needed help with. We could get no answer back in Germany or at Amsterdam, but they gave us, and we discovered that these were real needs. They weren't manufactured needs. And I said something to them to this effect, those things which you may need to buy, we will want to arrange that the budget for this is worked out in your money, in your rupiahs. And then they said, well, can't you give us dollars? Now what they had in mind, they would get an exchange over in Singapore or someplace like that. And then they'd get a whole lot more rupees. So they weren't very happy about this. And so I had to tell them, we have a policy in SICOM and in the Lutheran World Federation that when we help in any part of the world, we do it in the currency of that country. I said, we know that sometimes we gain, but sometimes we lose. And if we do the exchanging, then what we gain will make up for other places where there's a poor exchange rate. Then one old man sitting in the back part of the room said, Do you mean to tell us that if you give us a sheep and the sheep has a lamb, that you're going to take the lamb away from us? They're great about talking in pictures, and of course, that kind of touches the heart. But policy is policy, and in the long run, our policy helped the largest number of people. So I had to regretfully tell him that, yes, that was the way it was. Then they wanted to know, well, let me back up a little bit just to say a word or two about this great church. Two American boards sent missionaries out there and they were killed. Then finally the Rhenish Mission Society sent a Danish Schleswig-Holstein man by the name of Nomundsen, and he was spared. There were several efforts made on his life, but he escaped each of them. And he remained out there to become God's agent in the conversion of many people. And today they think of him as the apostle to the Bataks. And you find his picture in practically every church that you may visit. They wanted to know what was necessary to become a member of the Lutheran World Federation. And I told them exactly what the Constitution says. And one of the things that it says is that they must accept Luther's Catechism and the Augsburg Confession, and of course the Constitution of the LWF. Now I said, then they want to know, well, how long would it take? Well, I said, the Executive Committee can admit them, but it might be better for them to instruct their people in the congregations what was necessary, so that this would be a decision of the whole people. And I said, then you could bring your application to the next assembly, and I know that would be a festival occasion. Yeah, they understood this. And I went back from Indonesia to New York. And when I got back to New York, there was a cable applying for membership in the LWF. I thought they'd understood and that they had assented to the fact that they would take their time about this. Well, once they had sent it, we had to act on it. It went first before the Commission on World Missions, and then it would go to the Executive Committee of the LWF. And the commission said there were others there than just those who were acquainted with the Bataks. They said the reputation of this church being the largest and a strong church, there will be those who will say, if we admit the Bataks at once, ha, the Lutherans were eager to shear this lamb with a lot of wool, as it were, this big church, and bring it into their family. And I knew it was easy for our brethren in the International Missionary Council to come to such a conclusion. And if it were to happen, it ought to happen with understanding on both sides. When we brought this to the Executive Committee wanted to admit them at once. But the people in the Commission on World Missions were against that, for they felt that that would not be for the welfare of the Bataks, nor for good feeling in the whole missionary family. That is, the whole Protestant missionary family. So finally, the Executive Committee listened, and they authorized the sending of, Bishop Negrin, who was president of the LWF, he was to visit in India, and they asked Bishop Sandegren and me to go with Bishop Negrin, and then to invite the Ephorus of the Batak Church in one of his church council, and an interpreter. it was up to me to invite an interpreter, and I found a Methodist missionary in Indonesia who was of Swedish background and spoke excellent Swedish and excellent English. He was married to an American woman, and I'd gotten a good impression of him, and I thought, he being a Methodist, he's outside the Lutheran family, being Swedish, he could speak Swedish to Negren, or he could speak in English to all of us. And he became the interpreter for us. And by the time we were through with this consultation, then the Bataks agreed that before they presented their application again, they would present a copy of their constitution, and then a statement about the Augsburg Confession and Luther's Catechism. This came before us about 6 months maybe later, and came to the Executive Committee of the Lutheran World Federation. Well, they had not said anything about the Augsburg Confession, and the Constitution of the LWF says that you must accept the Augsburg Confession. Luther's Catechism, that was no problem, because they had used only Luther's Catechism for instruction of the young. And I knew that if this was turned down again, this would be tough on the Bataks. About a year had elapsed now. And the man who was the chairman of our little subcommittee of the Executive Committee was Bishop Meiser, I think you met him, Ed, of Bavaria. And he was known as very conservative. And we thought that Bishop Meiser might just say no if they hadn't accepted the Augsburg Confession. Well, now when they reported that they had not accepted the Augsburg Confession, then they explained it this way: our people do not know the Augsburg Confession, but we mean to go that way. Bishop Meiser called a halt, and we had a little quiet meeting. He and I think it was Bishop Meyer of Liebeck and myself. And then Bishop Meiser said this: it is clear, he says, that we cannot deal with a younger church in the same way in which we deal with the older churches of the West. And while I would want to hold them pretty much to the same thing, it seemed to me this was wisdom on the part of Bishop Meiser. I don't recall that I have any time heard anything wherein we have been faulted in our dealings with the Batak Church. Oh, just the time, well, this time, give us a few minutes. Okay, thank you. Maybe 5-10 minutes. The Vespers begins at 8 o'clock, if there are any questions. Now, I've talked all the time, and since it's narration of history, that's been sort of necessary. Yes?
Just a thought, as you were telling about being here and there and so many different places, I was just thinking about your family life. Was your wife along on some of these? Was she at home all the time?
Not at this time she wasn't along, because we had to make as much, cover as much ground as possible, and the budget of SICOM didn't have too much for travel. No, she was not along on these trips. Next time, tomorrow, I'll deal with some things from the time when I was president of the Lutheran World Federation. I had intended some of the work of the Commission on World Mission, but perhaps I'll jump to that. Then there was no, and had I not had a wife who was so thoroughly in sympathy with what I was doing, because we had originally expected, both of us, from college days on, to go to China as missionaries. But we were blocked in the doing of that because of the communists coming into China and all the missionaries being brought home. And so the board was not ready to send out any new missionaries. And then I accepted a call to this country. The children were younger. I think I've had a good relationship with the children. But obviously it was not. And in some areas wherein we serve the church, the family does have to suffer. But not once did my wife give any indication that she was suffering. And while we lived in New York and had a cabin up in northern Minnesota, she would take the three children and put them in the car and drive out there all the way alone so that they would not be robbed of that experience.
Was your life ever in any danger?
I cannot say that really was. Well, if there had been some guerrillas that had attacked when we went through across the out of the Dutch area into the Republican area, it could have been. But there we turned ourselves over in the hands of God. I believe He guided us, and having guided us, I was confident that He would also supply protection. Let me see, were there any other times? There may have been one or two other times in other areas, but nothing serious, nothing like if one were going through Cambodia and Vietnam today. There aren't any Lutherans in that part. Well, thank you. We'll meet again tomorrow night.